From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, San Franciscans voted to not demolish the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, but there are still questions about how we use our water.
So when you say to people, hey, do you want to desalinate the ocean, or do you want to recycle sewage and water golf courses with it? They say, yeah. And then you say, do you want to double your water bill?
Then we meet the invasive frog that's filling Golden Gate Park and destroying other native species.
These are cheap toy-looking amphibians with enormous hind claws and fat legs tapering into a simple wedge of a body.
The invincible frog. And what's in a hat?
I think the hat is just as necessary as a pair of shoes.
Cool cats in hats. That's today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The only local ballot measure San Franciscans rejected on Election Day was Measure F. It would have prompted an $8 million study into taking down the O'Shaughnessy Dam and Hetch Hetchy Reservoir in Yosemite National Park, which currently supplies water for San Francisco and dozens of other Bay Area counties. It would have also called for reviews of San Francisco's water usage. While nearly 78% of voters said no to the measure, considering how the city uses its water can be valuable. San Francisco recycles very little, if any, water, and heavy rains regularly cause sewage overflows. We called up Paul Rogers to talk about the issue. He's the environmental writer for the San Jose Mercury News and managing editor for KQED's science programs. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney.
You know, for people who want to know where the water comes from in San Francisco when they turn on the tap, you're drinking melted Sierra snow. So in the Sierra Nevada, when the snow melts and the water comes pouring down and goes into various rivers, one of those rivers is the Tuolumne River, which runs through Yosemite National Park, and Hetch Hetchy Reservoir is built there, and it was built in the 1920s, and it stores water, which then comes 160 miles through pipes down through the width of California into the Bay Area, and a lot of that water is stored in Crystal Springs Reservoir along Highway 280 in San Mateo County. And so when you turn on the tap in San Francisco, that's what you're drinking. It's the same thing when you turn on the tap in most of San Mateo County and Palo Alto and parts of northern San Jose and parts of Alameda County. The pros and cons of what San Francisco is doing with its water is they have not been very good in developing recycled water, which is taking sewage and treating sewage so it's clean, and then using it not for people to drink, but to irrigate landscaping and, in public parks and soccer fields and golf courses and things like that. Other parts of the state have done a lot more with that. Orange County does a huge amount of water recycling, and they actually now are blending that water once it's treated with UV and chlorine and all this other kind of stuff. They're blending it with the groundwater and then pumping the groundwater back again, treating the groundwater at treatment plants, and serving that to people to drink. In San Jose, Santa Clara County gets about 5% of its drinking water from recycled water, and there's more than 100 miles of these purple pipes that lead out from our wastewater treatment plant, and that water goes, again, golf courses, public landscape irrigation, stuff like that. And the city of San Jose and Santa Clara Valley Water District right now are finishing construction on a new $50 million plant to treat more recycled water. It's going to be in Alviso in North San Jose. It's opening in the spring. And the goal is to take the amount up to 10%. San Francisco has done almost none of that. They have a little bit that they've done with some North San Mateo folks to help fund recycled water to irrigate some golf courses that, some of which, like the Olympic Club, are in the city. And they have some plans to do three or four other recycled water projects over the next 5 to 6 years. But it's still a very small part of San Francisco's water.
Why is that? I mean, is it because they've got this great reservoir that they're taking so much water from, and so it enables them to be a little bit lazier on creating infrastructure projects and, like, putting their money in other places? Or is there another reason?
I think so. Hetch Hetchy is one of the best and most reliable and purest drinking water sources in the United States.
There's more than enough
environmental damage it did when it was built. It's a critical part of the Bay Area's economy and the Bay Area's infrastructure.
But that's drinking water then. I mean, it's good for drinking water. So
that's right, and it makes some people angry that we're taking that beautiful Sierra snowmelt and watering golf courses with it. And, you know, that's a good point. Now, recycled water, just like desalinated water, though, is expensive. You know, the water that a lot of places, a lot of cities buy, whether they get it from the Delta or they produce it from groundwater, it can cost something like $400 or $500 an acre foot of water. And an acre foot is enough for one family for a year, more or less. When you talk about recycled water and desalinated water, you can easily, very quickly, get well over $1,000 per acre foot. So when you say to people, hey, do you want to desalinate the ocean or do you want to recycle sewage and water golf courses with it? They say, yeah. And then you say, do you want to double your water bill from, you know, $100 a month or $80 a month to $160 or something like that? So agencies have to look at cost and benefit on the projects they do. And again, the cities in California that are moving forward with recycled water, and I expect San Francisco will continue to do more in the years ahead, one of the reasons that they've been doing it is that they can't rely so much on the other places they've been getting water, whether it's the Colorado River or whether it's the Delta. And, you know, Silicon Valley, San Jose, gets half of its water from the Delta. And there's all sorts of problems with the Delta and Delta water reliability and Delta water quality and, you know, endangered fish and that can reduce the amount you can take from the Delta. So some places that rely on Delta water are trying to create more of their own permanent supply, and that's where recycled comes in.
That's Paul Rogers. He's managing editor for KQED's science programs and the environmental writer for the San Jose Mercury News. He spoke with KALW's executive editor, Ben Trefney. Now that the reservoir is staying, what ideas do you have to manage water use? What conservation tricks do you want to share? Let us know on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And leave us a message. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. San Franciscans have chosen to keep the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir intact and not restore the valley to its original state. Still, if you went out to Yosemite's Tuolumne River, you'll find all kinds of river life. It's a great place to be at peace with nature and spot wildlife. But one thing you may not have realized is that we're in the middle of our planet's sixth mass extinction. And scientists say no animals have jumped onto that bandwagon quite like amphibians. That's frogs, toads, salamanders, newts, you know, the slimy ones. At least 160 amphibian species have gone extinct in the past few decades. But as amphibian populations in general drop, one particular frog is doing suspiciously well, especially in California. Science commentator Max McClure looks into why.
Science loves a frog. And why not? They're easily disassembled, they produce large numbers of transparent embryos, and they walk kind of goofy. But our dissectable friends aren't doing so well. Scientists have also noted that amphibian extinction rates appear to be anywhere from hundreds to tens of thousands of times higher than usual. There are many reasons for this, but it certainly doesn't help that frogs are currently in the midst of the deadliest vertebrate pandemic of all time. It's just a lowly skin fungus, albeit one with a fancy name, Batrachochytrium dendropatitis, or BD. But when it latches onto amphibians, the mold prevents them from exchanging electrolytes through their delicate skin, leading to cardiac arrest. Over the past few decades, the disease has severely affected more than 200 amphibian species on six continents. If you go to Lily Pond and Golden Gate Park, though, you'll see it's full of frogs. But they're not your standard Californian variety. Those guys are falling to the fungus. These are cheap toy-looking amphibians with enormous hind claws and fat legs tapering into a simple wedge of a body. Inelegance aside, they're doing very well. No heart attacks for them. That's partially because they're resistant to BD. But, and this is important, it's also because they carry it. The frog occupying Golden Gate Park is called Xenopus, the African clawed frog. As you might have guessed from the name, they're not from here, and they're extremely unwelcome. It's now pretty clear that their spread out of Africa was behind the BD pandemic. How did they get all the way over here? It's all about the eggs. Xenopus is an unusually prolific and hardy egg layer, which biologists know for a pretty crazy reason. Back in the 30s, a zoologist with the stunningly British name of Lancelot Hogben discovered that the frog was a really effective pregnancy test. That's because it responds to the same hormone that most pregnancy tests look for today. Want to know if you're expecting? Simply inject your urine into one of these frogs, and if it lays a clutch of eggs, you're pregnant. This worked so well that by World War II, British labs were already storing dozens of frogs on site in large galvanized metal tanks. Even the Family Planning Association clinic in London kept a few on call in the basement. But the bigger news, at least from the freaky perspective of lab biologists, was that this hormone turned the frog into the egg-laying machine they needed for large-scale developmental studies. By the 1940s, the animals were common clinical and lab equipment all around the world. Xenopus has since played an integral part in our understanding of not just development, but neurobiology, RNA, the cell cycle. It was even the first vertebrate to be cloned. Unfortunately, the frogs are also notoriously good at escaping from those labs. It didn't take long for wild populations to establish themselves in South America, Wales, and yes, California, along with a certain deadly skin fungus, which it's been spreading for nearly the past 70 years. In case you were wondering, the frog apocalypse we're now seeing has major consequences for humans. Amphibians are important parts of global food webs. They control pests, and they're promising sources of new medicines. But it's also worth pointing out that this biodiversity is important in and of itself. In order to study anything in a lab, you need to simplify things. That's what Xenopus is, a simple generic model, an every frog. But whenever you focus in on a model, you end up tuning out the complexity of the real world. Normally, this just means you make some incorrect assumptions, but in this case, something more worrisome is going on. The model is actually making the real world disappear, forever. There's an old physics joke about a couple of physicists who are asked to help a dairy farm increase milk production. They come up with a solution, but their equations only work in the case of a spherical cow. Imagine if those equations started bleeding into the real world, cows magically puffing up around the globe. Alternately, just look at Lily Pond and at the unintended consequences of science's love for a frog, a pond full of pregnancy tests.
Max McClure is a science writer in Palo Alto. You can hear all his science commentaries at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now let's take a listen to your stories from inside the booth of San Francisco StoryCorps.
There is nothing that I think lights up my life like having found something that no one else in the world has ever found before. The thrill of discovery.
Meet Dr. Ernest Marquez. After graduating from Fresno State in 1972 with a PhD, he worked at the National Institutes of Health until 2008.
Really what I've done primarily is to work to increase the diversity of the U.S. workforce, scientific workforce. And for that, I've been grateful forever.
Marquez, who is a Mexican-American, tells his friend Judith Camacho what it was like to enter an industry in which he was a minority.
In the biology department at Fresno State, I was the only Chicano guy there, the only one. They were in sociology classes, and they were in other classes, but not in science. So I thought, wow, this is really something. I think the experience has sort of persisted throughout the rest of my life. And even today at the National Institutes of Health where I work, I'm one of a few, which is not unusual. But once I came to the National Institutes of Health, my focus really was on, you know, how do we get people healthier? To do that, we need practitioners in the field who understand the culture, who understand the language, who... And this goes for all people, you know, it depends on where they are, and their cultures can be different even if you're white. The culture that we have in New Orleans versus San Francisco versus the Dakotas is different, and so the requirements for health are a little bit different as well. And so that kind of cultural knowledge, I think, is necessary for anybody who wants to go into these neighborhoods and actually practice medicine or help in any way. They've got to understand people as they are. Bridging the cultures for me was not difficult. I do it all the time. I do it with my wife, you know, because we are from different cultures, but we have a common ground that we share, and that encompasses both things. She loves Mexican food. She loves Mexican music. You know, when I listened to her uncle play opera and sing opera, I thought, this is fantastic, you know. So I can appreciate, I think, and maybe that's what it takes, is an appreciation of people's cultures, no matter where you are. If you walk into them, look around and appreciate them. And I think that's the important, for me at least, importance.
That was Dr. Ernest Marquez speaking with his friend Judith Camacho. Their conversation is part of San Francisco's StoryCorps. That interview was facilitated by Eloise Melzer and produced by Seth Samuel. And if you'd like to interview your friends, find out how at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time to meet your neighbors.
I like my neighbors. I like my neighbors.
It's kind of hard not to notice that it's getting colder. You can tell how cold it is by just looking at what people are wearing nowadays. Thicker leggings, furry boots, scarves, and of course, hats.
Grab your coat and get your hat.
San Franciscans have always loved hats. Streets were often a sea of hats, rounded bowlers, creased fedoras, wide-brimmed ladies' hats ornamented with flowers and birds. There's at least one place where the local hat-making tradition goes on, behind a nearly 100-year-old storefront in the Richmond District. In this piece from our archives, KALW's Ali Budner visited Paul's Hat Works, an old-fashioned men's hat shop, to meet the four young women who've taken up this almost forgotten trade.
When you walk into Paul's Hat Works, it's a bit like stepping back in time. The shop feels well-kept, warm, and decidedly old-fashioned, with wood counters and glass cases. There's an ornate yet functional metal cash register, an old record player, framed black and white pictures of people wearing hats, stacks of vintage hat boxes, and hats of every style hanging from brass hooks.
Do you want to try it on? Oh, yeah, the bow, actually. That's a custom bow, too.
Oh, it looks great.
My name's Kirsten Hove, and I'm wearing a black fedora with a short, curled brim.
Kirsten is co-owner of Paul's Hat Works, which dates back to 1918. All the previous owners have been men, none of them named Paul. But as of 2009, this San Francisco institution has been run collectively by four women in their 20s. The friends-turned-co-workers make a good team. They each fulfill their own niche in their quest to bring back the hat.
So why are we bringing the hat back? Well, I think the hat is just as necessary as a pair of shoes. So I think it's a functional item first and foremost. My name is Olivia Griffin, and I'm wearing an Optimo.
Olivia and her three business partners are all wearing hats, each made right there in the shop. Abby Dwelly is another one of the hat makers.
I'm wearing a fedora.
And last but not least,
my name is Wendy Hawkins. I am a hat maker, and I'm wearing a bowler hat.
Someone joked once that it was called hatitude, so we always say that, like the way in which you wear your hat.
Full house on Sunday.
A customer to Paul's Hat Works has just walked in the door to pick up an order, a refurbished hat that belonged to his late father.
He passed away 20 years ago, so I just found it in the old tack room, and I thought, oh, where do you have this hat? And looked at it and got the address up here, came up, wondered if they could do something with it. They said, oh, sure.
That's Urban Bernardo.
From Hanford, California. That's way down in Kings County. No hat shops down there.
Kirsten retrieves Urban's refurbished felt hat from a sliding cabinet behind the counter.
This was originally something that we would call like an open telescope or a loose pork pie.
Kirsten and her partners are dedicated to bringing back the old styles of hats, ones that used to be as common as today's baseball cap. Olivia says old-fashioned hats like the pork pie disappeared from fashion 40 to 50 years ago.
And there's a lot of theories as to why. JFK didn't wear a hat to the inauguration, and that was like a big deal because before that, everyone else had. He left it in the car, apparently, and the hatting company that made his hat were furious.
Another hypothesis? Cars.
It's hard to wear a hat in a car, so the car thing is part of it.
Or?
In my opinion, hair kind of abolished the hats, and we've joked about like picketing outside of hair salons like and stuff like that.
Whatever the cause, people just don't wear hats like they used to. So you might ask yourself, why would anyone choose this line of business today? Well, when the women of Paul's Hat Works tell their story, they make it sound like it was a matter of fate. But, oddly enough, when they purchased the shop, none of the women knew how to make hats.
So it's kind of scary to buy a business learning to do something that, or buying a business and not knowing how to do what it is that you're going to be doing. So, but a lot of us had a background in textiles, and Wendy had a background in running a business, and so it ended up being less scary than we thought.
For 6 months, the four women took a crash course in hat making with their predecessor, who'd run the shop for 30 years. Everything in the shop came with it. And that's really important because
you have to have very specific tools to make hats, and they're tools that aren't made anymore, which is part of why it's such a special and dying art. Like, you can't go to school to become a hatter because the tools just don't exist and the people don't know how to do it anymore.
Making a new hat is a highly customized process. When designing a new hat for a customer, they use an ancient contraption called a conformature. It looks like a metal top hat with levers and knobs all around it. It measures the precise shape and size of a head.
People often are like, oh, it looks like a medieval torture device. But then they're like, oh, that feels kind of nice. It's like a little bit of a head massage.
It's cold and it's very relaxing.
Kendon Anderson is a customer here. He's purchasing an Optimo, a hat with a thin raised spine down the center. Wendy removes a paper card with holes punched out from the conformature to reveal the shape of Kendon's head.
No one's head is the same shape. It's like a snowflake or a fingerprint.
The workshop, a tiny but neat room just behind the storefront, is where the hat really starts to take shape.
Hats, before they're hats, we call them bodies. You can also call them raw bodies or blanks, but we usually refer to them as bodies, which means before they have a shape in them. Basically, hats are made with steam. Like, steam is what makes a hat. It gives its shape. And then wooden blocks. Like, those are the two main tools.
Next, the hatters bind the brim and stitch in a lining. They can adorn the hat with ribbon and feathers, and voila! It's a bowler, an Optimo, a top hat, pork pie, Panama, or a fedora.
The fedora is the most popular, most common, looks good on almost every single person. The fedora is a gateway hat. Once you get the fedora, then you want to try a bowler, then you want to try a pork pie, then you want to try something else. So I think that it's the gateway hat to having a lot more hats.
Beware the gateway hat. It could easily turn into a pricey habit. The cheapest new hat from Paul's Hat Works is $250, and some are as high as $2,000. Now, that might seem over the top when you consider you could get a similar-looking hat for less than $100 at any store on the street today. But consider Wendy's approach.
I do basic math with people at the register. I'm like, how much did you spend on your laptop, on your cell phone, on your car? How long will that last you? 2 years, 5 years, 10 years if you're lucky and you don't drive that often? This hat will last you 80 to 150 years. So yes, it's $600, but divide that over how many times you'll wear it, over your lifetime, and then it's an heirloom for your family, and that's priceless.
So what's their vision for the future?
This is the groundbreaking for the Midwinter's Fair in Golden Gate Park, August 24th, 1893. And the only man in the whole photograph not wearing a hat is the mayor, who took off his hat to make a speech. And that's our goal. That's our goal, is to have everybody in a hat.
And after spending some time with the women of Paul's Hat Works, I have a feeling they could make it happen. If these merry hat makers have their way, they'll be bringing back not only hats, but also an appreciation for what is handmade, with heart, and of course, hattitude. For Cross Currents, I'm Allie Budner.
Since that piece first aired, the ladies of the hat shop report that business is going well. They've actually opened a custom workshop in a downtown men's store, and they're having a holiday party on December 7th for their customers and all hat wearers. And then you can join us the next day, December 8th, at the Oakland Museum of California, with or without your hat, for Cross Currents Live. I'll be there, the whole team will be there, and you can be in the audience. All details are at KALW.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, RTM's Konohovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, Eva Sonsin, Anna Sterling, and RJ Sloan. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. You're listening to the Goat Family Band, who started as a jug band. They play live tomorrow night at the Bazaar Cafe in San Francisco, and they want you to know that dancing and laughing are encouraged. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
The wind may blow all across the land.